Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Michael Keefe, author of the new novel All Her Loved Ones Encoded from Running Wild Press. Michael's short fiction has appeared in Tahoma Literary Review, Thin Air Magazine, Somerset Review, among other journals. He's also the events coordinator and publicist at Annie Bloom's Books, one of Portland's premier independent bookstores. He was formerly a music critic and currently sings and plays guitar in the local band Budget Airlines. In the words of Willie Vlauten, Keefe has delivered a haunting depiction of a near-future America where living virtually is both a debilitating strain on a failing society and the new American dream. At its root, though, this novel is all heart, the story of one family's struggle to survive in an ever-changing and collapsing world. Please join us for our conversation with Michael, which is already in progress. Well, Michael, thanks for joining us at KBOO today. We last talked on the radio, it was August 2019, so 5 years ago, pre-COVID, which seems like a whole different era.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that was for a show on Portland's independent bookstores, and you were representing where you work, Annie Bloom's Book, great bookstore. You've worked there since 2000, so welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me again, Ken.
Now, your work is based in a love of music. Before you turned to fiction, you started out writing poetry and then song lyrics. Mm-hmm. And you're both a musician and a songwriter. You even play in a local band, Budget Airlines.
That's right.
They're top of the charts.
yeah. If you could find the lowest possible chart, we would be at the top.
You know, I listen to some of the music. I'm going to play that, I think, for the intro to the show, and I enjoy it.
So. Wow. Oh, okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Now, some of that passion and talent for music must have come from your dad. His name is Joe Keefe, and he was a professional jazz drummer in Los Angeles.
Uh-huh. Yeah, back in the 60s. He played jazz drums, probably into the early 70s.
With some of those, like Shelly Mann, Shelly's Manhole, and some of those West Coast jazz guys?
More obscure than that. Yeah, I don't... He's actually the only recording that I know of him being on. He's playing, I think it's like some xylophone and maybe finger cymbals on an album like circa 1970 from this kind of avant-garde singer-songwriter, Esra Mohawk.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he was doing straight jazz, but also innovative jazz?
Yeah, that was just, you know, like kind of a recording session. I think his friend and my namesake, Michael Cohen, who's a pianist, was invited on that session, and maybe he tagged along, something like that?
Well, in any case, he must have been pretty good. You'd be a professional musician in Los Angeles at the time.
Yeah.
Were you around a lot of musicians growing up?
My mom and dad got divorced when I was three, so I think... that's pre-memory for me being around the
jazz. Oh, you were living with your mom then.
Yeah. But there were some jazz jam sessions in the house when I was a little kid, so I think I probably absorbed that, even if I wasn't actively around it.
Now, I mentioned in the intro when giving a little bit of your bio that you wrote music reviews and for journals like Pop Matters, Sound on Sound. How'd you go from music reviews to fiction?
It's just a very gradual thing. I wrote poetry and some short fiction in high school and college, took some creative writing classes, and dabbled around in like false starts to various novels throughout my 20s and 30s and never really got going. And then, I found the groove with writing the nonfiction music reviews and things like that. And then I just started writing yet another novel that probably wouldn't go anywhere. But then I got really into it and was getting a little fatigued of writing the music reviews and found out I wasn't really enjoying listening to music as much because I was always...
Because you had to, yeah.
Yeah, and I was having to always think about it critically and just try to listen to as much new stuff as possible, and it just wasn't feeling as enjoyable anymore, and I was getting called more to writing fiction, and so I just went for that.
Did your poetry, song lyrics, and music reviews influence your fiction? Maybe a few lessons learned along the way?
Yeah, I think probably just mostly in terms of description of atmosphere and place and sounds and things like that I've tried to carry over into my fiction.
And maybe kind of a more lyrical type of writing? Obviously not poetry, but song lyrics that don't necessarily have to rhyme. But
right, yeah, yeah. Although mine, strangely, almost always do. Because it's kind of more pop-centric, even if it's a little left of center, the songwriting. Yeah, yeah, for sure. All those elements, I think, have come together. And just, you know, organizing words into a cogent form for the music reviews and all of that. It's all came together to inform my fiction writing, I'm sure.
Now, the new book, All Her Loved Ones Encoded, mm-hmm. is your debut novel, but as you said, it's not the first novel you worked on.
That's right, yeah.
I think you have three in the drawer somewhere?
Or? Yeah, yeah. In addition to those ones that never got anywhere, I've written three other entire novels, two of which, prior to this one, I tried to get published and didn't get anywhere with. I think that's right. No, at least one of which. And a couple others, yeah, I just didn't feel were ready ever. And then this was actually my fourth completed novel and the one first one to get published.
Now, you did a book launch in Annie Bloom's.
Yeah.
And you mentioned putting two of those novels aside. You were asked, how do you know when a novel's not working? Which must be a major decision because you put all that work into the manuscript. I mean, you're probably hundreds of pages in by then. And then all of a sudden you decide, I don't think this is going anywhere.
Yeah, no, there were finished novels, and yeah, and it was partly the market decided one of them. You know, I submitted it to a bunch of agents and a bunch of small presses, and no one took it. So like, okay, well, I guess that didn't work.
That's not always reflects on the quality of the book, though.
Yeah, who knows?
Commercial reasons.
Yeah, and there was another one that I just never, for whatever reason, just I wrote it kind of while I was working on another one, and it felt, even at the time while I was writing it, almost as if it was more of an exercise. There was I think it was the first time I was writing exclusively from a woman's point of view. And so I was kind of trying that out and different things. So I never really had the intention of trying to get that published necessarily, even though I liked it.
And that was a first person narration from the woman's point of view?
You know,
because I know in the new book, you write from a lot of different characters' point of views,
right,
men,
yeah.
Men and women.
Yeah. Honestly, don't remember. I think it was third person.
but still, you had to get into the head of that female character.
Yeah, for sure. I try to write very close third person, almost first person when I'm writing in third person. So, I do almost forget it.
Now, you started Encoded. Let me just use that
sure,
for short.
Sure, sounds good, yeah.
That was in 2019, I think. So again, pre-COVID?
I was outlining it in 2019, and I don't think I actually started committing anything, you know, like writing the actual chapters until early 2020. And yeah, I didn't start submitting anything to my writing group until like maybe the first or second week of the pandemic. And
so it's so about March or April of 2020.
Yeah.
Now you wrote in the book's acknowledgments that the final version is very different from the published novel. What was your initial idea for the book, for the story?
Yeah. So the main character, Kiana, is her story occurs every other chapter, and that's the main...
Right, and she's in the present day of the book, which is the near future.
Yeah.
2057.
Yes, exactly. The present is the future. and so her story is, like, plot-wise, very similar. I was looking at the notes before my launch just to kind of refresh my memory of, like, how did this whole thing come together? And a lot of the action was very similar, but her reason for telling the backstory chapters, most of which totally changed, became very different. Before it was kind of this like sort of clever idea of like she had to narrate this particular thing in order to like activate some encoded lock or something. I can't even remember exactly what the whole thing was, but there were like keywords within the stories that she had to tell. And so these ridiculous premises where she'd be like, you know, kind of on the run and trapped in a parking garage and be like, so I got to tell you this little story here.
And what was the reason for her having to tell it? To get some object or to free herself in some way?
Yes. I don't actually remember. But there was some similarity in that she was still trying to save the memories of her dying husband. And I think it was to be able to maybe even like get to where he was. I think he was like in a warehouse or something somewhere that was locked. And so in order to unlock that, she had to unlock her memories, something like
that. And this is still kind of a quest in the book, where instead of looking to unlock her husband, she's looking for this unregulated terminal. And we'll get into that a little bit more of
exactly.
the plot.
Yeah.
But again, in the book's acknowledgments, you mentioned your writing group called The Guttery mm-hmm. and how helpful they were in the rewrite. You said, quote, "I scrapped huge chunks of the novel and took a new approach that focused on Kiana's present struggle," which I think is the desire to find this unregulated terminal so she can upload her dying husband's consciousness to this virtual world. How did the manuscript change and evolve?
So
I know you had that initial idea, the story, the unlocking.
Yeah, and I had quite a bit of it written, maybe upwards of 10 chapters or something. And we're going over it in the Guttery, as we do every couple or 3 weeks. We would get to my chapters and they would get critiqued. And, you know, at first everything was kind of going fairly well. And then as the backstory chapters started getting more and more tangential, I guess. And
those were kind of the flashbacks to her family history.
Well, it was a different setup before, but yeah, that's what I'm referencing. They're now all her family history, and before they were other kind of more, as I was saying, tangential sort of stories. So that was part of it that wasn't working, and kind of like I was saying before too, the implausibility of when she was telling them and why. Yeah, after, you know, a few months getting into the revision process or the critique process, I realized, yeah, this isn't working. So I'm gonna scrap a bunch of the backstory chapters that I had, and also modify a little bit of the Kiana storyline. And instead of her telling the backstory chapters out loud, it became more just kind of like a reflection of what was happening in the main novel.
It provides a lot of background and context for what's happening, again, in this present day of 2057.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's all related to her. It's all her family history.
Exactly.
So you're not taking an event out of history and just putting it in these alternative chapters, or interstitial, I think, is the word you use.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. And it was becoming more like that, sort of these exercises and exploring different places and periods of history that had less and less to do with Kiana herself.
Now, grief is a central theme in the book. And I mm-hmm. think the impetus actually behind the book's premise, which is uploading the minds, the consciousness of our loved ones to this digital world. So in effect, they live forever. That's the encoded in the title. Mm-hmm. Now, your dad, Joe Keefe, died in 2019, the year you started writing the book. So you were going through your own personal grief at the time?
Yeah. He passed away in June of 2019, and I'm definitely still processing that. When I was writing the initial drafts and notes for this novel, and I think that carried in through into 2020, and then the pandemic hit, and everyone was grieving at that point.
Yes, it was personal grief you were writing from, but also this kind of global, universal grief with people suffering and dying from COVID.
Yeah, absolutely. So those things came together, and I think there's both of that in the novel.
Definitely. Yeah. I think it's so universal, the premise, because the main character in the book is Kiana, as we mentioned, and the book's present day 2015. Her mom is dying, Ellen, a.k.a. Taylor. She's a fugitive.
That's right.
On the run from an eco-terrorist group. And her mom's partner tells her, talking to Kiana, once Ellen Taylor is gone, all we'll have left are the old-fashioned reminders of her life. Some photos, a few videos, our memories. And Kiana replies, "It seems impossible that mom could be reduced to that." And that's something we all face when we lose someone we love, someone close to us. And I'm sure you felt that way about your dad.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And it is amazing just how few, you know, solid objects there are now, partly by choice. You know, you kind of like cull through those things during that process and keep the things that are most important to you.
We kept almost everything. My dad died about 2 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We're still going through it.
Well, it took a while.
He was 95, so he lived a good long life. But yeah, it's a shock. All of a sudden you lose somebody who's so close to you, and it's really the whole reason we're here. My existence mm-hmm. is totally due to him. Well, also my mom. But
let's give her a little credit.
Give her a little credit. So you start writing after your dad dies in 2019, less than a year later, COVID pandemic. during that time you were processing this, these two kinds of grief, the personal mm-hmm. grief from your own experience, your dad dying, and this pandemic grief, everybody dying all over the globe, and such a time of uncertainty. And I think you've said it was time to reflect that in your fiction, to write something dark and intense.
Mm-hmm.
So did that change the course of the manuscript besides the actual premise of, you know, she's not, Kiana's not unlocking things anymore by telling the story? These chapters are really her family background, again, adding context to the main story.
Yeah, I think it did. It became more personal, relating to Kiana, as you were saying, rather than being more, a little bit more of an intellectual pursuit before. And like I said earlier, trying to be clever and trying to be, I found myself feeling it more. It's more of a heartfelt exercise.
And though she's not going through the COVID pandemic, because this is, right, 35 years after that, but it's a dystopian world, and mm-hmm. it's very difficult to live in that world. And that ability to upload your loved ones to this digital world through this app called Level Up, you extrapolate all that from our current technology. Level Up as an app starts as a video game, mm-hmm. which we certainly have today, morphs into a virtual world, which we, where people can interact as avatars.
Right.
And we certainly have that. We've had that for several years now. Can you talk about how you created Level Up? You mentioned in the book, it's become this multi-sensory internet, which can encode and transmit sights and sounds, taste, smell, and touch.
Yeah.
A few of those things aren't quite possible yet, but of course they will be soon.
That was my feeling. Yeah. I felt less like I was creating something new than just following kind of the logical progressions. Like, seems like this will be possible at some point in the future. And sure, why not 2057? And then I just did, you know, some research into like, okay, yeah, people are already kind of looking into this and studying how it might be done. So that makes it seem even more feasible, even if it isn't happening right now. And
well, there's that famous William Gibson quote, "The future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed."
Yeah, there you go.
And he also writes a lot of science fiction that takes place in this near future.
Yeah. He was one of the pioneers of that for sure. You know, along with Aldous Huxley, with Brave New World. And I think.
There's a reference to that. When we think of dystopias, of course, we think of Brave New World. And you mentioned Orwell's 1984 in there. Kiana's mother, Ellen, actually, when she learns about Level Up, she likens it to the Feelies.
The Feelies, yeah.
In 1984. So that must have been somewhat of an influence, too.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was written about, what was that, like 80 years ago? 1984?
Probably. Oh, 1984 in the 30s or the 40s? Yeah. Brave New World was maybe in the 30s and 1984, 40s, 50s. Yeah, I can't remember pub dates exactly, but yeah.
And I'm sure some of the concepts in the book and a lot of science fiction today go back to H.G. Wells and Jules Verne.
Sure, so, yeah.
We've always had these ideas.
Yeah.
Now, in the Level Up worlds, living is relatively trouble-free, but it can be a problem. And a quote from the book, "The general theory held that brains actually got bored of virtual perfection pretty quickly. At first, folks would travel the world, have lots of casual sex, maybe do some skydiving. Then, like so many retirees from days gone by, they'd start searching for meaningful activities to fill their idyllic days, or they would succumb to Level Up inertia." Now, Level Up inertia is just, they're bored out of their gourd?
Yeah, basically, that's the idea. Uh-huh. Yeah. Too much of a good thing.
So a little trouble is preferable, certainly more human. I think at one point, Kiana says life without friction is meaningless.
Yeah. And there's an early chapter from her husband Javier's point of view where he takes a little trip into Level Up with their daughter.
Their daughter who died from a virus spectral fever several years before this present day in the book.
Yeah, so this is just a couple of years before that, when all is a little bit better in their world for sure and in the world in general. And they take a trip to the beach and Javier encounters some guy that he used to know, he used to work with, who's been dead for a little while and has just taken it upon himself to go with his little spear and clean up made up trash off the beach.
That's
which he's,
right.
You know, invented for himself basically just to give himself something to do. Otherwise the beach is totally pristine from other people's perspective, but he's put trash on there in his
video. But as you make that analogy, it's kind of like somebody who retires from a lifetime of work and all of a sudden they just have golf and I don't know, watching football on television and drinking beer with their buddies, and it gets tiring.
Exactly.
I mentioned, again, the main story takes place in 2057, and we do have flashbacks to younger days, all related to Kiana's family, going back to her great-grandfathers, in fact, who encounter each other at one point in the book in the very last year of World War II, where there's still some combat. And we have chapters, for example, set in 1945 Germany, East Berlin of 1964, Northern California in 1991. So you want to tell a multi-generational story and maybe also provide some context for the events happening in the book's present day, how Kiana and the real world got to this point, this dystopia.
Yeah, and you know, I was trying to do it without kind of hitting the reader over the head with it, but introducing themes of just like gun violence and, yeah, like video games in the 1991 scenario. The protagonist in that story is kind of disbelieving that these guys would just be sitting here on the couch shooting up fake monsters while their girlfriends are sitting around bored and kind of hitting on him. And then like a bigger theme, her great-grandmother Ilse escaping from East Germany during the Cold War is linked to an escape that Kiana has to make in her timeline. So I was trying to make some commentary and then also have these pieces that reflected on what was going on in her struggle at that moment.
Are any of the collected worlds of Kiana, and again, based on her family history, do they have any links or roots in your own family history, Michael?
Not too much.
Like any Germany in the...
No, I don't think so. Maybe some very distant one. It's just, for me, has always been a fascinating period of time and a place, you know, that divided nation and the Berlin within that has always struck me as super interesting.
So you had the last days of World War II in Germany, but also an escape by, is it Kiana's grandmother or from East Berlin?
I think great-grandmother,
Oh, great-grandmother,
I think it's the great-grandfathers who meet in World War II, and then great-grandmother, one of the daughters of one of those guys.
Yeah, and an incredible escape. I could just see the movie, you know, when I was reading it. She's swimming across this river that separates West Berlin from East Berlin. She's getting shot at, and she has to stay underwater. She had been practicing for a long time, holding her breath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I put a lot of research into that chapter, with very specific little points along the Spree River and under bridges, and how can you actually climb down at that point? And what were the turrets like? And, you know, those sorts of things, the guard towers.
Yeah, what were some of your sources? Because it's not just that scene. It's almost every flashback, very graphically detailed.
Oh, yeah.
You're there. The reader is there.
Oh, good. Thank you. Yeah, a whole hodgepodge of stuff, of getting actual books, looking stuff up online. I've never been much of one for making phone calls to
doing interviews?
Reaching out. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's your thing. But not mine. I did reach out to a couple of people, I think in particular for that chapter, that Berlin 61 or whatever it was, 60s chapter.
Oh, 64, I think. Yeah.
64, thank you. I forgot all my own timelines. About getting, about the wall and where it extended and things like that, just to double check things. But for the most part...
Yeah, very convincing.
Thank you.
I mean, you're actually, like I said, you're right there with her as she's escaping, and there's a lot of suspense. And again, that's not the main story of the book, but it's so much fun to read.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, looking up pictures on, you know, German library archives and things like that. Yeah.
And this dystopia in Kiana's world in 2057, you must have also researched global warming, submersion zones.
Right.
She's on the Central California coast, so there's some walls there, but there's also a lot of damage from rising sea waters. And so that must have taken some research about current conditions and maybe projections of what things are going to be like in 20 to 30 years.
Yeah. That research was a little easier because plenty of people are doing that research for me of projecting. Unfortunately, what places are going to be, you know, probably underwater.
You could see maps on the internet online.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that was based primarily on that. And then even just recent news of like highway collapses in Central California, coastal highways and things like that. So, yeah, that was the easiest part of the research, was and, kind of projecting.
And you don't
that.
Have to work hard to convince a modern day reader of any of that when it seems like almost every week there's some terrible climate change related storm, a flood, hurricanes, like Asheville, North Carolina got hit a few weeks ago.
Right. Yeah.
Who would expect that?
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems to be out of control at this point.
Yeah. And even since I finished the book, it seems to be like getting worse and worse all the time. And the AI boom that's happened even since.
Right. So it's
that,
not so. Just climate change.
Yeah.
She lives in this fictional town, Costa Perdida. Mm-hmm. So that translates as Lost Coast.
Right.
Right away, it sounds kind of dystopian.
Doesn't
yeah. sound good. And it's suffering not just from climate change, but political crises, which we can see right now, just before our yeah. presidential election coming up in 2 weeks or so. Financial crises, which we can certainly see, those are cyclical. There's people who suffer all the time, not having enough money, not having food, not having health care. And so even though the novel's set in 2057, I couldn't help but think of our own current dystopia here in 2024 with all the bad things going on. So we're not that far removed from what's happening in the book. In fact, I think you were almost optimistic to set it 30 years in the present could be 10 or 15.
Yeah, that's probably true. And when I was thinking about technology, I was also thinking about a potential sort of technological slowdown, or that the world would be in such a place that they would kind of, yeah, stop inventing things or improving things at the rate that they had been.
And then just things falling apart.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So some of the technology I intentionally didn't make all that super powered because I thought that it seemed possible that, you know, we would sort of, again, that kind of a different kind of inertia, I think, innovative inertia.
Though
probably.
You do have droids.
There are droids, yes. Yeah. AI
not,
droids.
Yeah, not friendly ones.
not in that case. No.
No. Now, again, a big part of the plot, given this dystopian future, you have people in the novel committing suicide, these mass suicides, after mm-hmm. they upload their minds and consciousness into this personalized level up world for them, because they could live in this world. You called it a land where dead people aren't exactly dead,
mm-hmm.
kind of like Javi's friend and then their daughter, Kiana,
right.
and Javi's daughter.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the difference between the real world and level up's virtual worlds? And for example, Kiana and her husband Javi in the real world, though still interacting with those in the virtual world like their late daughter.
Mm-hmm.
They're in the real world, but they can visit these virtual worlds and they can interact with the people who are dead.
Yeah.
Who are uploaded to the app.
Right, yeah. So it's you know, kind of like logging into a video game, but they're wearing these sort of neural nets on their heads and goggles and things like that, you know.
And that's the multi-sensory.
The VR glasses sort of thing. So they're fully immersed in this other alternate world, which in their case, they have just like a simulation of their own actual home, but everything's a little bit nicer. And their daughter is virtually alive in it, which is much better, of course. But then they have their avatars of themselves who are constantly in that world, but, you know, kind of running on autopilot. When the actual people aren't there inhabiting their avatars, the avatars are still there, sort of just moving around and making their usual, like, pre-programmed parenting decisions and those kinds of things.
So they could be in two places at once, in
yeah,
effect, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
In the real world, and then their avatar representing them in this virtual world.
Right.
It's just an amazing feat of world building.
Oh, thank you.
I'm curious how he came to that. Did you just kind of sit down? I know you said you were more of a plotter than a plotter, P-L-O-D-D-E-R. So you do more outlining and take a lot of notes before you actually sit down and write.
Mm-hmm.
So there must have been a lot of details to work out in this, you know, this future world, especially this technology, this you know, how people can be dead and live on, and how real people can be in these two places at once, in the real world, maybe suffering, and then their avatar in this virtual world and maybe living a little bit better.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, a combination of like what we were talking about before, of like what could happen, and comparing that to what I sort of need to have happen or want to have happen for my own authorial purposes of getting this plot and story down. And trying to find that compromise between, like, okay, what would it be? It would be great if this could work out this way in order to build this, you know, amount of tension. and to have her goals be to get her husband's memory uploaded. It has to, you know, be a certain amount of idealistic in this world, and how is that going to work? Yeah, it's kind of making those choices and compromises with myself, basically, and comparing those to what seems plausible.
And what makes it difficult, which keeps the main story and main plot going,
right,
is that it's no longer as easy as when Kiana's daughter died and she and her husband uploaded the daughter, Anza, to Level Up. Since there's all these mass suicides, the government has throttled internet speed, so it makes it impossible for people to upload themselves to these digital worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And that sets the plot in motion, because Kiana then has to search for an unregulated terminal, and a few of those exist, but they're illegal for the average citizen to own.
Right.
And you have this line very early in the book: it's outrageous to Kiana the degree to which a handful of people in power control everyone else's lives.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking, isn't that the human condition?
Yeah.
I remember visiting two separate trips. One was Russia and one was China.
Mm.
And you think, man, there's hundreds of millions of people here. In China, billions. And you know, they're under the thumb of a very repressive government in both countries.
Yeah.
Why is that? Mm-hmm. Again, just a very few powerful people have everybody else at their beck and call.
Yeah, and, you know, in America, too, to like a less...
It could happen again, but I think it happened for 4 years or
right?
Not quite as bad as it could be if it happens again. But
yeah, or, you know, the six people on the Supreme Court who get to decide...
Right, whether a woman can have an abortion or not.
Yeah, exactly.
Her whole life is controlled by these men.
Yeah. Mostly men.
that's true. I just noticed it in the book. I could identify with that. These people are barely scraping by. Again, it's a dystopia. Their life's very hard, and the government just made it harder for them. One of their few escapes.
Yeah, and it all comes down to what is essentially a modem. call it a terminal. And I think there is actually, that's an official term for a different, you know, kind of modem. Terminal. So I borrowed that to make it sound slightly less pedestrian, but it is still fairly pedestrian. She just needs this bit of, you know, technological hardware, as you were saying, to be able to enact this thing, and she just can't get it.
And throttling is something that's going on now. Usually,
sure, yeah.
Not quite as nefarious. It's usually, you know, somebody's watching a lot of Netflix and their internet provider might think, oh, you're using up too much data.
Uh-huh.
We're going to slow things down for you.
Yeah. So it's just an extension.
We talked a little bit about the narration before. It's narrated in the third person close point of view. So close meaning from the perspective of an individual character. And there are multiple characters in the book, not only Kiana and her family, but secondary characters of diverse backgrounds, nationality, ethnicity. Was that a decision, Michael, to be as inclusive as possible in the novel, in fact telling us how this dystopian future affects the most vulnerable and powerless in society?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wanted Kiana to be kind of a, you know, even though she's American, to be kind of a global citizen. So I wanted her to have a really varied background.
Yes, Germany, Hawaiian.
Yeah.
There's a few others in there I'm probably leaving out.
There are a bunch, yeah. At some point she recites, I think, like all eight of her, you know, from like grandparental lineage or something.
And her husband, Javi, too.
Oh, yeah, sure, right. Yeah, she is married to a Mexican-American.
Javier Gallegos, is that it?
That sounds right. Yeah, I just think of him as Javi. That's mostly how he's referred to. But yes,
right.
He does have that Spanish last name. And so, yeah, there's a lot of different ethnicity in there. And at one point, Kiana encounters, I believe she's a Syrian American in jail.
Oh, in jail, right.
Yeah. And I think it was just maybe her parents who had immigrated to America, or possibly her grandparents. So, I was wanting to tell that sort of a global story within this kind of, on the one hand, the limited
kind of
context.
This restricted framework in terms of the geography.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And mostly just right in California in 2057. And even the other stories are mostly kind of Western set here in the US or as we're saying in Germany. So, that was a goal of mine for sure, is to have that aspect of it.
Now, we talked about how the book evolved during the writing, and that was also true of the title. I think you said the working title at first was simply Encoded.
Yeah.
So why the change?
Yeah, and that was actually toward the end, you know, when I had my computer files, it was just always Encoded and whatever date of the draft I was working on. And I think when I was submitting it to my writing group, I would just put Encoded on the top, in the header. And But I never wanted it to be just a science fiction book purely, because I felt like I was telling these very human stories. And even though we've talked a lot about the kind of more science fiction-y elements of it, I consider it literary fiction first and foremost. And yeah, because of the change in the orientation of the story toward Keanu's family members, I really wanted to have the title reflect that too. And so I thought about it. It's really all about all her loved ones. And so I, you know, tagged the original title onto the end of that after the comma.
That's an interesting distinction between sci-fi and literary fiction.
Uh-huh.
Because there are some very literary sci-fi writers like Ursula Le Guin, who sat in this room probably several years ago before she died.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, she was a good friend of the station and did some interviews here.
Yeah, a lot of the borderline sci-fi novels that I like are classified as literary fiction. You know, I kind of referenced a couple of them when I was, I think, on the back of the book and when I was pitching this to agents and presses, of like Jennifer Egan's Visit from the Goon Squad and then Candy House, which came out subsequently to my getting the book accepted. Hilary St. John Mandel has some sci-fi elements to her things. One of my blurbers, Ethan Chatanier, his wonderful novel Singer Distance was a recent favorite of mine. And that is also, I think, I consider it literary fiction with some sci-fi elements to it. A recent book, In Ascension, was another one. I don't know if you know that one. Martin McInnes, I think, is the author.
And no, I don't.
Yeah, it's a really great one, too. And it's also,
but I know when we talked before, Michael, so that was as part of this independent book store roundtable. I think the books that you said influenced you and the writers were people like Thomas Pynchon, Don DeLillo, James Joyce's Ulysses. Pynchon, I'm a huge fan of, probably my favorite writer.
Oh, wow.
And I would say, yeah, he's sci-fi, but he's, I think there was a famous argument between, I think it was Margaret Atwood and Ursula Le Guin on the difference between science fiction and speculative fiction.
Sure, yeah.
Whether there's a difference or not, they thought there was a good-natured argument, debate
good.
About it. Ursula Le Guin was on the sci-fi side, and Atwood, like even The Handmaid's Tale, she wouldn't regard that as sci-fi. She would regard that as speculative fiction,
right.
Which I think is closer to what you're doing here.
Yeah,
You're extrapolating from the way things are now to where they might be in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, that's another good comparison. And when I'm thinking of the shelves at Annie Bloom's books, Margaret Atwood is always in the regular fiction section.
Right. Oh, yeah, I don't think she'd be in sci-fi anywhere.
Yeah.
And yet certainly you could make an argument that there's a little bit of that in there.
Yeah. So that was what I was aiming for with this novel, too, is to have it be literary fiction with some speculative / sci-fi elements.
Right. There's not funny names, alien names, and they're not going to other planets and visiting alien civilizations. So to me, that's more kind of a traditional sci-fi.
Yeah, the hard sci-fi.
Yeah, yet you still make up this, you create this world, which is very convincing.
Oh, thanks.
But also not surprising to people who are living today or reading it today. Now, I read one review of the book. It called it a swift-moving dystopian pleasure. I love that term, dystopian pleasure.
I love that too, yeah.
It sounds like it should be an oxymoron.
Exactly.
But I actually think a lot of art operates that way. It's pleasurable to read. It's not pleasurable if you were living in that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And, pleasurable. People, obviously, that's a subjective reaction. But I think, you know, in terms of like kind of lighting up those brain neurons that like to engage with human emotion, whether it's necessarily negative or positive, but just to feel that resonance is maybe what they're getting at with that. A dystopian pleasure is like
I think they mean it's a good read.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good shortcut way of saying what I was just trying to say there and flailing around with, that it resonates with you on some level. Yeah.
Right. Now, the Swift moving kind of interests me more because I think that's definitely true. Hmm. In fact, as we mentioned, Kiana's story, again, the present date in the book 2057, and all these flashbacks and other chapters, and they alternate. Mm-hmm. So some of the chapters go back to 1945, again, her family history. But, you know, that started happening, it goes throughout the book, but about halfway through, I couldn't wait to get back to Kiana's story.
Uh-huh.
It's a thriller, in effect.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
So we follow her. She's looking for this unregulated terminal. She tries to buy it off the black market. Turns out she's been set up and a cop
yes.
arrests her there. She gets put in jail. She has to escape from prison because they want her home address, and her husband's dying there, and they don't want the cops to see that because then the whole jig is up in terms of uploading his consciousness to
exactly.
level up. So she breaks into her place of employment, which is a desalinization plant in, mm-hmm. in Costa Perdida. She wants to steal an unregulated terminal. She knows they have one there. She has to avoid the droids
right.
when she's doing it. And then she has to return to her dying husband, even though she's being pursued by the police and their droids, and upload his consciousness before he dies. And he's on his last breath, pretty much,
in the
book. You throw in a sex orgy in there as well. I should mention that to readers who want a little bit more of that. So how'd you map out these action scenes? It almost seems like a movie that was storyboarded. She's going to be at this place at this time, and she's going to run into this problem. How is she going to get away from it? And then she's going to run into the next problem.
Yeah, I think it goes back to my love of the Odyssey.
Yes.
Yeah. And I
You're
use
just
that.
Kind of a quest.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I used that when I was pitching the book to Odyssean, just that idea.
Yeah. He just wanted to get home.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So this is the same
but
thing.
But he took the long way.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was basically doing the exact same thing, just ripping off the Odyssey. Like, okay, she leaves the house and all she wants to do is get back to the house, but she has to do this thing first and kind of complete these tasks and, you know, the ill wind blows her far away from that, and then she has to get back to it. So a lot of the sort of plot points that I mapped out in 2019 stayed fairly similar to what I had originally conceived of.
Again, that main story.
Yeah. But I was just, like, looking just like, okay, what's the next obstacle that I can throw in her way to to get her off track when she's trying to remain on track?
Yeah, you did a fantastic job of that. I mean, it was with her every step of the way. And I think the escape by her great-grandmother, Ilse, from East Berlin, mm-hmm. also was portrayed in the same way, depicted in the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
It was very suspenseful.
Oh, good. Yeah, and I was trying to strike that balance with, because of those interstitial chapters that go back and are, maybe aside from that Ilse chapter, less thrillery. And perhaps just more kind
of
like
yeah,
standard
the book
fiction.
Is by no means a mystery thriller genre fiction.
No, I know what you mean, though.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was trying to strike that balance of, like, keeping the reader in suspense but not having them overly frustrated, where they're just going to throw the book across the room. It was like, I just want to stick with the plot and not not visit Kiana's great-great-grandparents.
Well, I think that's when you hit on these flashback chapters would all be her family history.
Yeah.
Because then we've already met Kiana and we're just interested in her story because I think she's a very likable character. We're certainly rooting for her. I can't imagine somebody who wouldn't be.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to imagine that person.
No, I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to have a beer with him or vote for him, for that matter.
There you go.
Now, the new novel is published by Running Wild Press. Mm-hmm. They're an independent publisher. They're based in Los Angeles. How did you connect with them?
Admittedly, it was basically just through blind luck. I was, you know, scouring all the different websites for publishers who you could submit to directly. I first tried to get an agent and didn't have any luck with that. And for those who don't know, if you don't have an agent, a lot of the publishers are closed off to you entirely, like Penguin Random House and...
Well, certainly the big commercial ones, like the New York ones.
Yeah, yeah. And even a lot of the, you know, kind of cool, like maybe middleweight publishers. Like Tin House is very hard to get into. I think they have like 2 days a year that they accept unagented submissions. So, yeah, a lot of doors close to you as an author if you don't have an agent. But there are a lot of great independent presses out there that are looking.
Your wife, Liz Prado, works for one of them.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. She works with Laura Stanfill on Forest Avenue Press, which is one of the best independent presses, I think.
Absolutely. Yes. I'm glad we got a shout out for Forest Avenue in there. Forest Avenue.
I do several interviews with their authors. They publish about 2 to 3 books a year.
Yeah.
I have to say they're as good or better than anything I've read by the big publishers too. So
exactly.
I really think independent presses are kind of keeping literature alive in the country so it doesn't become kind of formulaic and too commercial and you're just publishing stuff by a celebrity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I was by no means like really disappointed about not getting an agent and being published by Houghton Mifflin. It was just kind of the process I went through and then started looking for independent presses and was very happy and not feeling at all resigned to that. But also wanted a press that felt like they would be sympathetic and a good match and all of that. So I was,
yeah, talk about matches. I looked at their website. It says they welcome work that crosses genres and time periods.
Yeah.
Your book is perfect for that. You do both.
And I remember thinking that when I discovered Running Wild and was reading about them and looking at the other books that they published, I thought, wow, this sounds like it would be a really good fit, which doesn't necessarily mean that the publisher will think that. But in this case, fortunately, they did.
Well, there was one obstacle which you managed to hurdle, and that was they accept mostly POC and women writers, or they encourage them.
And they have a whole separate sort of imprint within Running Wild called Rise, I think.
I think that's it, yeah.
Yeah, and initially when I got my acceptance letter, they referenced that and said, we would be happy to publish you under our Rise imprint. And it was kind of late at night when I got this acceptance letter or when I found it maybe a couple hours after it had been sent in my email. And so I was like, yay. And then I thought, wait a minute, isn't that their imprint that publishes people who aren't cis white guys like me?
Is that something I didn't know at the time? And then they decided to publish you under the Running Wild imprint rather than Rise?
It seemed like it was, possibly a typo or who knows what it was, but it wasn't a problem at all. It turns out the next day. But yeah, it was a huge celebration and the moment I read the email and then like, oh no. So I had to sleep with that or try to sleep with that.
But all that's in the book. I mean, it's all in the fiction. It's all these different characters, men and women. And
yeah,
as we mentioned, of different ages, different ethnic groups, different nationalities.
Yeah, yeah.
So multiple voices, which I think is what they're trying to encourage here, mm-hmm. rather than say the white male college professor is just writing novels, academic novels.
Right. Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with it, but you want to read other things too.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
But a lot of literature was like that for a while in the U.S. Mm-hmm. especially.
Yeah.
Now, as mentioned in the intro, Michael, you're the events coordinator and publicist at Annie Bloom's Books. And you've worked there going on 25 years now, since 2000. How has that influenced your own writing? I mean, you're around books all day. You're dealing with authors. You're dealing with publishers. You're dealing with editors. And you work with some really top writers in town, too.
Yeah.
Amo Daviau and some others. But, it's this haven for writers and readers in Southwest Portland and Multnomah Village.
Yeah, oh, thanks. Yeah, Annie Bloom's is a great place to be.
See, I could be a publicist too.
Yeah.
But it's true. And I've been going to Annie Bloom's for a long, long time. I love the place.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's been a wonderful place to be. And I started there when I was 30. And certainly my reading has expanded since then. And what I find interesting has evolved.
Do you read a lot then of the books that come in? Maybe just to browse them to see if it's the right fit for Annie Bloom's and their customers, their demographic.
I don't do any of the buying for the store, so I don't preview anything in that way. So I'm mostly reading to see if it's something I might recommend on our staff favorites table.
Oh, and then you might get recommendations from your coworkers too.
For sure, yeah, all the time.
Pretty
widely.
We're
always talking about, hey, what are you reading right now? Right now? Oh, that sounds great. I hadn't thought about that one. I'll try that out. So yeah, there's a lot of cross-pollination with my coworkers for sure. And yeah, I try to read like at least every other book that I read is probably like a brand new release or a release that's coming out in the next few months.
Do you have something you read recently that you'd recommend to us?
It's already out now. The Sally Rooney Intermezzo, her latest.
Oh my, that's gotten a lot of press.
Yeah, rightfully so. It's fantastic. It's in my top 3 of the year, if not my favorite of the year.
And anything that you anticipate coming out, say, early next year?
Yeah, I haven't started reading it yet, but at the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association conference that just happened recently.
I think that was 2 or 3 weeks ago, right?
Uh-huh, yeah. I picked up a reader's copy, an advanced reader's copy, as they're called, of the Charlotte McConaughey, is that her name?
Oh, I don't know.
The author of Migrations and Once There Were Wolves. I might be butchering her name, even though I really love her writing. Migrations was one of my favorite recent novels.
And she'll be coming out with a novel early next year.
Yeah, it's coming out in March, so I'm very excited to read that one because I love those two recent novels of hers. I think that's number one on my looking forward to list. Yeah, I'm otherwise...
And I think it will be available at Annie Bloom's, I hope.
I'm sure it will be available, yeah. Yeah, we sold many, many copies of her other novels, and I'm sure we'll have a stack of the new one as well.
Now, I wanted to get to a few coming attractions.
Yeah.
Your work, you have a short story collection coming out next year. It's called Western Terminus, Stories and Novella. This is published by Cornerstone Press. Can you give us a preview of these stories that you wrote over a long period of time or very recently? Are they kind of speculative fiction, like Encoded? Mystery, thriller?
Right. No, they're more straightforward contemporary literary fiction. There are a couple that have some slightly magical realist elements to it, but not too much leaning on
that. More present day than this near future, this dystopia.
Yeah, if anything, present day and recent past. The novella goes back and forth in the chapters between present day and the early 80s when the protagonist was a kid. And it's about his family and returning to his childhood home after his dad has died. So that's a running theme to kind of live in the house that he grew up in and that he fled with his mom and sister when he was a kid.
Did you write that after your dad died?
Yeah. That novella I wrote, I think, right after All Our Loved Ones Encoded. I think that was the next project that I worked on. And it was kind of built on another novella that I had scrapped, but kind of a similar setting.
You're a very productive writer.
I am a very productive writer.
You're always working on something.
Yeah. I've written a couple of novels since this one, as well as that novella.
And there's one in the pipeline. I think you talked about it. It's mm-hmm. a mystery novel.
Yeah.
So somewhat of a genre, I guess. Fictional town in central Oregon. And you also tell a multi-generational story, like Kiana's story in All Her Loved Ones Encoded.
Yeah. So, those are two separate novels. I've got one called Damages Carried Down. That's a finished novel.
Oh, that's the one that I was talking about. Yeah. Oh, it's finished. Oh, I didn't realize. There was one you talked about, four characters during the 20th century.
Correct, yeah.
1930s Brooklyn, a grandfather's war journal in German. So again, World War II in Germany.
World War I, actually.
Oh, that was World War One. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So that one takes
place.
So
that goes way back.
Yeah, that novel, Damages Carried Down, takes place entirely in the 20th century from 1914 to 1984. And yeah, it's three generations. As you were saying, the grandfather's war journal, the protagonist in 1984 believed that her grandfather was British and fought for the British side, and then finds this war journal written entirely in German. And she took German in college years ago, so she's kind of like pecking her way through a translation of that. At the same time, taking care of her brother and going through a divorce and other things. And also being antagonized by a member of this other family who was kind of a rival German family now in America.
Again, a lot of research must have gone into that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you're attracted to, as it seems, to these multi-generational tales.
Yeah.
Which are a lot of fun to read.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. For some reason, even though I'm not particularly interested in my own.
I was actually curious about that. If you went to, what is it, 24 and I forget what the name is, where people send
23 and Me. Yeah.
23 and Me.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And now apparently they've been hacked and people are worried about their DNA getting, or are they going under or something like that?
Right.
And people, hundreds of thousands of people might be affected in terms of the DNA getting out to, I don't know to what nefarious purposes.
Wow. Yeah.
Sinister. Yeah, well, this is the next novel.
For sure. Right for that,
Lex Luthor-like mad scientist with everybody's DNA.
Uh-huh, yeah.
What he's capable of doing.
We'll name him Elon Musk, just as a random name to throw out there.
Yeah, he's probably one of the most evil men right now.
Yeah, there you go.
In my opinion. It's a perfect name.
Yeah.
But Michael, I want to really thank you for coming in again. I hope it's not another 5 years, but I love the book. And
well, thank you so much.
Wish you all the best on it.
Thank you for having me. It was a really fun time.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Michael Keefe, author of the new novel, All Her Loved Ones Encoded, from Running Wild Press. You can learn more about Michael, his work, and all his upcoming events online at michaelkeefauthor.wordpress.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, November 14th at 10:30 a.m. And we should have a new president by then. I hope it's the right person. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then.